KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A group of tribes want the U.S. government to explain how it historically funded Indian boarding schools. As Jimmy Romo reports for the Mountain West News Bureau, the tribes recently filed a lawsuit aiming to force the country to reckon with the past.
The Wichita and affiliated tribes of Oklahoma, along with the Washoe tribe of Nevada and California, filed a lawsuit in Pennsylvania Federal District Court. It seeks to hold U.S. agencies responsible for the Indian boarding school system. Native children suffered horrific abuse and neglect in these schools, and many never made it home. According to the complaint, boarding school operations were funded by Native Nations trust funds. Those funds contained proceeds from the sale of tribal land, land that the U.S. government forced tribes to sign away. The trust, plaintiffs say, was meant for the collective benefit of Native Nations. It is estimated that the government used $23 billion in today's money to run the boarding schools. The tribes are asking the courts to force the U.S. to give a breakdown of how the funds were used. The U.S. government has yet to respond to the complaint.
That was Jimmy Romo reporting. The Apache Stronghold, a coalition of Apache people, other Native people, and their allies say the group's fight will continue to protect Oak Flat in Arizona. This after the U.S. Supreme Court Tuesday declined to hear the group's lawsuit, Apache Stronghold versus United States. The case seeks to stop the government from transferring Oak Flat, a sacred site to Apache and other Native people, to Resolution Copper, which plans to turn the site into a mining crater. In a statement, Dr. Winsler Nosey Sr. of Apache Stronghold said, "They'll never stop fighting and that nothing will deter them from protecting Oak Flat from destruction." He goes on to say, while the decision is a heavy blow, their struggle is far from over, and they're urging action from Congress while they press forward in the courts. Resolution Copper welcomed the decision and in a statement said the mine is vital to securing America's energy future, infrastructure needs, and national defense with a domestic supply of copper and other minerals, and says the project will create jobs and boost the economy. Attorneys for the Apache Stronghold say they'll continue to do everything in their power to ensure the Apaches can continue worshiping at Oak Flat as they have for generations. The FBI says it will add resources in 10 states, including New Mexico, to tackle unresolved crimes, with a focus on those related to missing and murdered indigenous people, but not everyone is convinced it will have a significant impact. More from Roz Brown.
The FBI has said 60 agents will be deployed to Albuquerque to investigate unsolved crimes. Tribal attorney Darlene Gomez has spent her career advocating for missing and murdered indigenous women. When it comes to investigations, she says accountability can be lacking.
When the Department of Justice or President Trump enact legislation or special task force, we very rarely see any of the data that comes out of what those task force were supposed to accomplish.
Prior to the FBI announcement, the Trump administration scrubbed an online report from the Not Invisible Act Commission, mandated by bipartisan legislation and signed into law by President Donald Trump during his first term. Gomez has a friend who's been missing for 24 years, so she's encouraged New Mexico recently adopted the Turquoise Alert, a system to help locate missing indigenous people, similar to an Amber Alert for missing children, and already operational in California, Colorado, and Washington. Nonetheless, Gomez worries New Mexico is backsliding on its commitment to locate the missing.
I feel like New Mexico was once the premier state in the country working on murdered, missing indigenous women and relative topics, and we were making huge, significant strides. And now we are down at the bottom again.
I'm Roz Brown.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Arctic Encounter Symposium, North America's largest Arctic policy event at the Denaina Convention Center and Anchorage Museum, July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska. Registration for this global conversation at arcticencounter.com.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Turns out that bowhead whales really talk a lot when they're migrating, and so that works out very well with the hydrophones.
Scientists in Utqiagvik use underwater microphones to help count bowhead whales. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 28th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Girdwood breaks ground on a new childcare facility that will dramatically expand capacity.
This building is being built not just to house the students that we have at this very moment, but to house the future of Girdwood.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Senator Lisa Murkowski was among hundreds of visitors in Haines last weekend for the Great Alaska Craft Beer and Homebrew Festival. In a wide-ranging interview, she touched on the major tax and spending bill passed by the U.S. House of Representatives last week and its implications for the hundreds of thousands of Alaskans that rely on SNAP benefits and Medicaid.
This is something that the House just passed out. I am still digesting it. I have not. I mean, it's massive. And the consequences are quite substantial.
The bill aims to pay for President Donald Trump's sweeping tax cuts, in part by cutting federal Medicaid spending. The bill would do so by implementing work requirements for adults without children or disabilities. It would also require states to check some participants' eligibility every 6 months. Murkowski says both moves could shift costs to the state.
You know, our legislature just wrapped up this week. There wasn't a lot of spare change laying around anywhere. And the idea that the state is going to be rushing in to pick up additional costs, I don't think that there's going to be much appetite to do that.
Alaska Congressman Nick Begich, a fellow Republican, voted for the bill, saying it would keep taxes low and, quote, drives more accountability for social safety net programs. But critics say millions of people could lose insurance coverage as a result. Nearly 40% of Alaskans rely on Medicaid. Murkowski says if the state can't pick up the slack, Alaska's most vulnerable residents will suffer.
If what ends up happening is more costs are pushed to the state can't absorb it. Those individuals will be dropped.
Murkowski says she's more optimistic about the trajectory of Secure Rural Schools. That's a Forest Service program that provides funding for schools, roads, and other municipal services. Congress failed to renew that funding earlier this year, leaving major holes in school district budgets across Alaska. The budget reconciliation bill just passed by the House includes a one-year extension, which Murkowski said is not enough, but is a good start. The community of Girdwood has one licensed childcare facility, and the building is on its last legs. Officials recently broke ground on a new building that will dramatically increase childcare capacity in the resort community about 50 miles south of Anchorage. While construction is going smoothly, Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports that a loss of federal funding has put the future of the project in jeopardy.
It's a sunny day in Girdwood, and a construction crew is up the road from the Alyeska Ski Resort, paving the way for the new Little Bears Child Care Center. Crystal Hoke says it's a major upgrade for the community.
The current building is only the two classrooms split between the two cubbies. This will be seven classrooms with a multi-purpose room.
Hoke is the project manager for the Girdwood Child Care Project, aimed at bolstering the area's workforce. She says the resort town is known for decades that more childcare was needed, The old building wasn't cutting it.
It was actually referenced in the 1995 area plan for Little Bears needing a new building, so that's how long it's been needed for. And it became kind of more dire in 2011 when the municipality nearly condemned the building that they're in.
In the wider municipality of Anchorage, finding affordable childcare has been increasingly difficult, with rising costs, wait lists that can last a couple years, and the loss of a quarter of centers in recent years, according to THREAD, a childcare advocacy nonprofit. For years, the current Little Bears facility has been able to provide care for between 27 and 29 kids daily. Factoring in part-time care for some kids, the facility serves just over 30 families. And while it has space for toddlers, Little Bears currently doesn't offer infant care.
They got to be one and walking to even join our school.
That's Little Bears Executive Director Rachel Byers, who has personally experienced the struggle to find childcare in Girdwood. She says the lack of infant care in town led her to get a new job for a while to be close to childcare.
With me, I had no infant care for my oldest, and I had to leave Little Bears my first time working there and take a job in Anchorage and drive her every single day to Anchorage to work and then every single night back. So a lot of times that will happen or families will leave.
The new facility will almost quadruple the childcare capacity to 112 kids, including two infant care classrooms. Byers says the expansion is coming at a great time when Girdwood is building more housing. She says families moving in will need childcare.
This building is being built not just to house the students that we have at this very moment, but to house the future of Girdwood.
Hoke, the project manager, says it was a long road to piece together the funding to start building the new facility. She says the project received about $1.6 million in American Rescue Plan Act funds, which required a local fundraising match. Additionally, the project got money from the Rasmussen Foundation, the Forget-Me-Not Foundation, and a state grant for pediatric development. Even the land the site is built on is a donation. Hook says they're leasing it from Alyeska for $1 a year.
It was really exciting because this is really valuable land. It was valued over $1 million of just the value for this. And so we're extremely grateful for this acre. It definitely feels like a major donation.
However, one large chunk of funding is unclear. Hook says the project was supposed to receive $980,000 from the federal government, but that money hasn't been distributed amid the Trump administration's pausing and canceling of various grants. Hook says that money would cover the missing $500,000 the building needs for completion, as well as building a playground.
Because that has not occurred, we are very much in a gray space of not knowing what's going to happen. And so all we can do is continue to fundraise, mostly privately, to see if we can close that gap.
Hook says they have about a year to secure the funding. Still, she says, the halt in federal dollars isn't stopping the project from moving forward.
There's already so much of it that's ready to go. Our design is fully ready. Our building permits are done. You know, equipment is moving on the ground. We can't stop now.
Hook says the new expanded Little Bears facility is on track to open for students by fall 2026.
Hey, everybody, say it was an easy road to get here.
So easy.
Reporting in Girdwood, I'm Wesley Early.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, rescuers in Seward help free a man trapped under a 700-pound boulder.
The sound of those large boulders rolling against each other, it makes a pretty distinctive sound, and being hit, and I remember being hit in the back pretty hard.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Go to dot.alaska.gov/construction to learn about road, airport, and facilities projects across the state. You can zoom in on projects in your community using the interactive map, view traffic impacts, download data, and look at construction photos that will update all season long. Visit dot.alaska.gov/construction to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
A hiker from Seward was struck by a 700-pound boulder on Saturday and spent almost 2 hours pinned face down in a glacial creek. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin spoke to him today and reports on a rescue where everything went right.
61-year-old Kel Morris says he's surprised he survived.
Were there moments pinned there in the creek that you thought maybe you wouldn't make it out?
Oh, yeah, I was pretty sure I wouldn't.
The Seward Fire Department's account of the incident makes for a dramatic reading. It says, quote, the patient was found lying in the creek on his stomach with an approximately 700-pound boulder on top of him, with his spouse holding his head out of the water, unquote. Seward Fire Chief Clinton Kreitz says a lot of stars had to align for Morris to survive. One is that Seward Helicopter Tours had a chopper nearby and ferried rescuers and their gear to Morris. Kreitz says that saved about 45 crucial minutes.
When they first got there, he was in and out of consciousness, so I'm not sure, being that hypothermic, how much longer, you know, if he had 45 minutes left or not.
Another star is that Morris's wife, Jo Roop, is a police officer for the city of Seward. Kreitz says she knew exactly the information dispatchers needed.
Not just giving us directions of we're up the canyon, she gave us exact coordinates.
It was a beautiful day, and Morris says he and Roop were hiking up 4th of July Creek and followed a branch called Godwin Creek. The canyon narrowed. Morris says he tried to find a way around a patch of rocks, but turned around, figuring that route was impassable. That's when the rock pile let loose.
How I slid was kind of a blur, and I obviously lost my footing and fell down, and I ended up face down in the river, and the sound of those large boulders rolling against each other, it makes a pretty distinctive sound, and I remember being hit in the back pretty hard.
Morris's left leg and the left side of his torso were pinned. He says he felt at times that his femur was about to break. Roop worked for about 30 minutes to try to move the boulder and then decided to hike out of the canyon so she could get cell service. At that point, Morris was strong enough to hold a push-up position to keep his head up. Even in that dire situation, Morris says his wife had a sense of humor.
She graciously tells me, don't go anywhere, I'll be right back.
Rescuers from the Seward and Bear Creek fire departments used airbags and other equipments normally used to extract people from car crashes to move the boulder. An Air National Guard helicopter took Morris to safety. Morris spent 2 nights in the hospital, but somehow escaped with little more than bruises. He says he's walking, and if there were music nearby, he'd dance. Reporting for Alaska Public Media, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Palmer Mayor Steve Carrington will stay in office after voters rejected his recall during a special election. The Mat-Su Sentinel reports the recall was defeated 222-176, according to unofficial election results released Friday. About 8% of the city's registered voters participated in the election. In an interview, Carrington said, quote, common sense is still the majority in Palmer. Officials with a recall Steve Carrington group thanked voters for their participation. Preliminary results released after polls closed Tuesday showed recall supporters winning by a narrow margin of 99-97. That count, though, did not include early or absentee ballots. Proponents of the recall alleged that Carrington is guilty of official misconduct because he overstepped his authority when he hired an outside attorney last year without first obtaining city council approval. Carrington said he authorized the agreement due to legal uncertainties surrounding accusations against former Palmer City Manager Stephen Jelly, according to a statement included on the special election ballots. Carrington will remain in office until the city's regular election in October. He does not plan to run for re-election. With so many school districts recruiting from places like the Philippines, it means more people are learning about the U.S. immigration system. KMXT's Brian Venua reports in part two of his feature series, Mabuhay Sa Alaska. The process can be pretty complicated and is only becoming more stressful.
It's my third school year already in Kodiak, Alamboro School District.
Sergio Gutierrez stands above a crowd of 120 hopefuls in a conference space in Metro Manila in the Philippines. It's the first of six groups of teacher candidates he and other representatives of Alaska schools are scheduled to meet with on this recruitment trip.
So, today, you're going to start here, initial screening. Okay, this is the start of your dreams.
Many in the Philippines dream of moving abroad for higher salaries, more opportunities for growth, or travel. Juliet Tapado, drove an hour from Cavite City, then waited over an hour more at the doors before the session.
This is my third attempt applying and attending this interview.
That means she's been screened each time Alaska recruiters have come to the Philippines for teachers. She says the last frontier state is at the top of her list. She hasn't applied anywhere else in the U.S. Tapado has family and friends who have been successful in Alaska. She wants to join them.
There are a lot of school districts looking, so I might be one of those blessed aspirants.
If the recruiters like her or one of her peers, that's just the first step on a long road. Administrators ask candidates questions about classroom management and how they connect with families. They're also screened for skills like English fluency and their ability to respond to questions quickly. Only a handful of the hundreds at the initial screening get called back. Principals at schools across the state pick candidates from the pool of endorsed applicants, and only a select few are offered jobs. Gutierrez tells the crowd this is where the U.S. and Philippine governments get involved.
So you need to go through Visa Application Center, get your biometrics, get your pictures done, and once you're done, you need to schedule a U.S. Embassy interview.
Teachers also have to pay hundreds of dollars in application fees to the U.S. Embassy and work with the Philippine government's Department of Migrant Workers and its licensed agencies. After arriving in the U.S., but before starting in classrooms, the new employee has to file for teacher certification and a social security number. All of the paperwork gets pretty complicated. That's why at least seven Alaska districts work with immigration lawyer Russell Ford for help. Ford of Ford Murray Law, based in Maine, has public school districts and private schools as clients across the country. He helped his Alaska clients figure out which visa was most appropriate.
So when we met them, most of their teachers were on J-1.
J-1 as in J-1 visas, which are supposed to promote international cultural exchange and allow foreign nationals to live and work in the United States for 3 years. In the past, many Alaska school districts hired from abroad through third-party recruiting agencies that used J-1 visas. Now that administrators are recruiting directly, with Ford's help, some have shifted to using H-1B visas. Those are designed for high-skill jobs like teachers and allow for longer-term careers in the U.S.
If everything is working out, then there's the possibility of sponsorship for permanent residence or a green card.
That opens the door for districts and communities to build long-term trust and relationships with international hires. Neil Frank Rivera Ferrer is the Philippines' Consulate General in San Francisco and provides immigration services for Philippine nationals across 10 states, including Alaska. He says switching to the H-1B visa is the right call.
We would prefer if those that are coming to Alaska and coming to the U.S. in general for work purposes should get a work visa, the H-1B visa. Instead of a J-1 visa, which is really more of a temporary, cultural, short-term visit to the U.S.
But U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services limits how many H-1B visas it issues each year. There are more delays processing applications since President Donald Trump was reelected, and his administration has been tough on immigrant communities. Ford says it's left him and his clients with some uncertainty.
I'm having conversations that are a little tougher. It's about people's fears. It's about, can I go home? Should I go home? Can I travel? Do people want me here? So I'm doing more counseling and not from a legal sense, but just having someone to talk to.
He's trying to run business as usual, but makes sure to remind clients to be extra careful to follow the law and avoid attracting negative attention. At least one Filipino migrant in Kodiak was arrested by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, commonly known as ICE, in April. Elsewhere, ICE has deported other legal Filipino immigrants. But for Juliet Tapado at the Manila recruiting event, it wasn't her year, but she still thinks the work is worth it.
I'm still hoping that somehow in God's time, in God's beautiful time, I could be able to get my dream and achieve my dream working in Alaska as an English teacher.
She's already planning to keep improving herself to be a better candidate next time. Reporting in Manila and Kodiak, I'm Brian Venua.
KMXT reporter Brian Venua examines how and why Filipino teachers work in Alaska schools for his Mabuhay Sa Alaska series. Visit KMXT.org to listen to the full 5-part series and podcast.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Scientists and hunters have been counting bowhead whales passing by Utqiagvik for the past 2 months. It's part of a once-in-a-decade effort to evaluate the health of the whale population up north and support subsistence in the area. Aliona Nyden with the Alaska Desk reports that so far the number of whales seems to be on the rise.
When bowhead whales pass Utqiagvik on their way up north, it's a good time to count them. These calls, recorded with an underwater microphone, were from whales swimming there last month. Every 10 years, scientists and local hunters team up to carry out the census for bowhead whales that migrate between the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas. North Slope Borough biologist John Sitta says the data helps ensure that the bowhead population is healthy. It's also used to set subsistence harvest limits in the years to come.
We do it for the whaling captains, and we do it in collaboration with them. You know, they've taught us how to be on the ice safely.
First, they build a perch on the sea ice, right on the edge with a stretch of an open water, or lead. Observers have been climbing the perch and counting the whales passing by since the beginning of April, when the census started. The visual count continues throughout the spring bowhead migration and is only the first step of the census. Scientists will also need to statistically adjust the data. But so far, Sita says the final estimate might be around 20,000 whales or more, a significant increase since the last census numbers, which were released in 2019.
Yeah, so we think there are a lot more whales out there now than what there used to be, and that we suspect the populations continue to grow, but we just don't know that for certain yet.
Sita says the bowheads might be thriving because the sea ice in the Arctic is declining. The change in conditions can also lead to more competition with humpbacks, predation from killer whales, or collisions with ships. Sita says the only way to know is to continue to monitor the population. Whalers in the Arctic have been involved in the bowhead census since the early 70s. That's when the International Whaling Commission, an organization that regulates whaling, counted whales for the first time. That estimate was so low that the commission reduced the harvest. The hunters objected to the limitations and asked for another census. Retired whale biologist Geoff Carroll co-led subsequent counts.
We're able to improve our techniques over the years. We're able to show that there's plenty of bowhead to support the subsistence hunt.
That initial count only included whales passing through the stretch of open water. But hunters knew that some animals traveled far from shore or under thick ice. Throughout the years, the census has included acoustic and aerial surveys that account for those whales. This year, the acoustic part of the count is also happening. Scientists place hydrophones, underwater devices that record ocean sounds, at the bottom of the sea and will retrieve them this fall. They will use the recordings to see how many whales pass through the area, says Carol, who is also an advisor for this year's census.
It turns out that bowhead whales really talk a lot when they're migrating, and so that works out very well with the hydrophones.
Biologists will also fly above the Beaufort Sea and photograph breaching whales later this summer as part of an aerial survey. Sita says that with sea ice becoming less stable each year, counting whales from a perch is getting more dangerous. He says that with time, scientists hope to rely on aerial surveys. After the count is done, scientists will need to process the data, which can take up to 2 years. The International Whaling Commission expects the final estimate in 2029 to decide whether to renew the region's current subsistence whaling quota. In Anchorage, I am Aliona Nyden.
Seniors across the state graduate from high school this month, and that includes Sandpoint School's class of 2025, who donned their caps and gowns for graduation last week. But the 8 graduates were not just turning their tassels to commemorate the end of high school. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Eastern Aleutian School's first class, which graduated in 1975. The Alaska Desk's Theo Greenlee attended last week's celebration and sent this audio postcard.
Thank you for coming here tonight to help us celebrate our 8th grade promotion and the senior graduation. Everyone, please welcome Whitney Smith.
Thank you, Asia, for introducing me. If I had to describe my class in a few words, it would be competitive, smart, and unique. We don't always agree, unless it's about getting Mr. Martin off topic or trying to convince Mr.
My name's Navai Marcus, and I just graduated.
Or telling Mrs. Phillips
that I'm going to college in UAA.
It's an incredible honor to stand here today to celebrate this remarkable group of students. Morgan, Julian, Brayden, Ralph.
Asia Marie Mark, Walls. I feel sad, but also happy.
I've had the privilege of knowing many of you since preschool, watching you grow from
Karen Walls. Overwhelming because, she will be gone for 3 months and she always come home. I miss your home cooked meal. And then that's just a week long, but this time it's gonna be months.
Julian Cole Carlson.
There were days I didn't think he was gonna do it, but he proved me wrong.
Charlotte, my grandma. It's Julius, my dad. Karen McMillan, my teacher.
I had him in kindergarten.
They think I'm gonna leave and do something stupid.
It's just the fact that you're leaving with two other guys going to the same place and we're
I'm not saying there's not gonna be chaos, so.
Graduates, please rise.
I'm Brayden Gatlin. My mom, Megan Gatlin, just graduated. My mom's a principal. That's actually pretty cool to have her sign my diploma and all that, so.
Caden Cruz Foster.
School here has been going on for 50 years. That's just crazy to me. My grandma Carol Foster was a part of that.
Well, it's changed a lot in 50 years, so I'm just glad I'm still here to enjoy it all.
Yeah, it's just a sign of how strong this community is. That's each of these events is really more about the whole community than it is about the individual kids. That's the beautiful thing about our remote small schools is these events are community events, not individual celebrations. A smile
from a friend. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the graduates of the class of 2025.
I feel pretty great. I'm proud of the accomplishments me and my graduating classmates have had.
Don't let life ruin your dreams.
Sean Michael Kalugin. Yeah, I feel inspired after seeing all those slideshows and stuff. I think I want to be me.
Proud of you. You're pretty great.
That was an audio postcard from the Alaska Desk's Theo Greenlee at the Sandpoint School's graduation ceremony last Wednesday when 8 graduating seniors received their diplomas. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Avery Elfeld in Haines, Wesley Early in Girdwood, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Brian Venwa in Manila and Kodiak, Aliona Niden in Anchorage, and Theo Greenlee in Sandpoint. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media. Thank you.
Now that I've tried to talk to you and make you understand, all you have to do is close your eyes and just reach out your hands and touch me. Hold me close, don't
I'm not afraid to And how do I know, and where do I get my belief that things will be alright again? What words do I use to try and explain to those who've witnessed all my tears? And what does it mean to know all these things when love's been wasted all these years? When love's been wasted all these years, standing in the shadows with my heart right in my hand, removed from all the people who could never understand. I was a pilgrim for your love, a pilgrim for your love, a pilgrim for your love. I was a pilgrim for your love. It's like living in a nightmare, like looking in the blackest hole, like standing on the edge of nothing, completely out of control. Now where have I been all these years? And how come I just couldn't see? Like a blind man walking round in darkness, I was a pilgrim for your love. I was a pilgrim for your love, standing in the shadows with my heart right in my hand, removed from all the people who could never understand. Standing in the shadows with my heart right in my hand, removed from all the people who could never understand. I was a pilgrim for your love, pilgrim for your love. I was a pilgrim for your love, a pilgrim for your love. I was a pilgrim for your love.
time with me. Your wish is my command. Never thought of falling up again. Fucking with my best friend. That's all right with me.
Generation to generation, it gets passed on.